Welcome to another episode of Foolproof Theology. My name is Chase Davis, and I'm your host. It's great to be with you here again. We have Joe Rigney, Dr. Joe Rigney, on the show, a returning guest. So I'm glad he, is still willing to come on the show after all the drama of the last year on the podcast. Joe, thanks for being a returning guest. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Yeah, it was iffy. It was 50-50, but, I figured I'm just going to do it. One more time.
Just one more time.
We'll see.
Last time.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, for sure. We're going to get into your book that's coming out. Is it out yet? It's coming out soon. Leadership and Emotional Sabotage.
Yeah, middle of March, early March. So depending on when this airs, it could be right before or right after. Who knows?
Great. All right. Well, listener, you can look for a link to the show notes to at least pre-order, if not buy, this fantastic book. Really short, really accessible, principled and punchy enough to really apply it to your life easily. We're going to talk about that first. Something I've been wrestling with, if you've kept up the news with our church, we're joining both the SBC and CREC, which is its own topic for another day. You can actually go tune into my church podcast, Just Say It, where we talk about some of that stuff. But Joe used to be at Bethlehem Baptist. Now he's up at New St. Andrews. He's a fellow of theology. Are you on staff at Christ Church up in Moscow?
I am. I'm a chaplain.
Chaplain. Oh, wow. Okay. Like in war.
We'll build and fight. That's what we do.
That's great. You're the chaplain to the fighter. So one of the things that I've been curious to know more about is that journey, because from Baptist and CREC is mainly Presbyterian, although they accommodate simple-minded Baptists such as myself. I'm curious to know, with that move, where did you kind of land on that? Have you landed somewhere on Credo baptism versus Pado, because you were Credo. You've been Credo your whole life.
Right.
And now where are you at?
Yeah. So, at Bethlehem for years, I've described myself as basically like a soft Baptist, by which I meant like the issue itself. I see really good arguments on both sides. It actually is a complicated question that gets into like all of the nitty gritty of how you put the covenants together and all that kind of stuff. And it seemed that there were good arguments on both sides. And so I've been kind of like, I see both. And then my confidence level on credo baptism has always been like a 60-40 thing, where it's like, I could be wrong on this. And I want to be able to work well. So and Bethlehem was really great in that respect, because for all those years, because it is Baptist, but it's not what I would call Baptist. So,
truly
back in the day, truly Baptist, which basically meant like Piper, back in the day was advocating for open membership. It was basically like, hey, conscientious Presbyterians, we want to welcome them to membership. I thought that was a helpful thing. And so Bethlehem isn't that way. He lost that fight. But in terms of that argument of, you could have a tighter eldership that was credo, but then have a membership that wasn't, that was always compelling to me. And so I've advocated for that and desiring God and things like that. So that's kind of where I've been, in terms of, the shift and the move out here. The presenting issues were more related to like political philosophy, Christendom, all of those sort of things. And that there was kind of a difference in vision, between me and certain leaders at Bethlehem over those things. But in the process of that, basically like one of the things that kind of emerged late in the game, but was still a part of it, was, hey, I've been a 60-40 and I can kind of see how some of these things seem to hang together. Maybe I need to kind of reopen that, because I hadn't really gone back to look at that in any detail in a while. And so I kind of reopened that, took that off that shelf, and it was basically like, oh yeah, now I see some things, this is not 50-50. So when I left Bethlehem, it was like 50-50. And then my wife and I, continued to talk and talk with folks out here, reading some things and getting clarity on kind of what I thought the nub of the issue was. In that debate, and then finally got to the point where I was like, no, I think that I'm a Pado Baptist. Like this is more compelling to me, for a number of reasons. So we tipped the scales, and then a few weeks ago, we baptized our youngest son. Our older boys are baptized as believers, but our youngest son, we baptized him at Christchurch.
Excellent. Okay. Well, is there one thing, because I always have Presbyterians in my DMs, pushing me, and I'm always just like, man, I'm probably 80-20. This is kind of where I'm at. It's not that I discount the arguments, but they're always trying to read this book. You got to read this book. And I'm like, no, like I've got other things I need to focus on. Right. You can pray for me. I always welcome people to pray for me, mm-hmm. but I would be curious to know for you, you know, was there one argument? It's obviously cumulative over time. And then situationally, yeah. I would say, you know, that the presenting issue was now that you all of a sudden you're at a Presbyterian church, you've got to make a decision. Like this is kind of a significant moment, but at the same time, was there an argument that you heard that you were like, okay, I'm convinced now.
Yeah. I think the two things that were probably the strongest, I mean, there's a lot that goes into it, but like two things. One is I think, the idea of the household as a thing that God recognizes as a unit, and that it operates according to a principle of headship. This is all sort of stuff that like, I think Baptists and Presbyterians agree on, or, you know, conservative ones do. So there's a head of the home. And the key thing was, and he can speak on behalf of his house.
Okay.
So it was sort of like, I can say, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. I think I can say that, biblically. So if that's true, what implications does that have for that baptism question, which intersects with the church? And I think that a lot of the ways that sort of Baptists try to, you know, work through that felt to me like that just doesn't actually work. And that it was more, oh, that the household's a thing. It was a thing in the old covenant. It's still a thing in the new covenant. And all of it, it should be done in the Lord. So you raise your kids in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. They obey in the Lord. All of that kind of stuff was kind of more, they're regarded as insiders, not outsiders. Well, how would you sort of represent that? Well, baptism is the way that you represent that. So that was kind of one piece. I think the other piece was more actually inadequacies in certain answers on the Baptist side. So in reading things by, you know, probably the best Baptist systematic theologian like alive today, Steve Wellum, and has done all this work on progressive covenantalism. And I know there's differences, you know, Jared Longshore, who came out here, kind of came more from like the 1689 federalism camp, whereas progressive covenantalism was more of a thing at Bethlehem because the influence from Southern Seminary. So like Jared and I've kind of been comparing notes on like, well, what was, are those the same or different, or what's going on? And the thing that kind of always struck me was, is that I would find myself saying amen, amen, amen to a lot of things I read in like Wellum when he was actually talking about the progression of the covenants and all that kind of stuff. And I still think that, like, I'm like, yes, 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 yes. But then it would always get to this point eventually where it would be like, and therefore the new covenant community is a pure community and there's no mix. Mm. There's no mixture. The new covenant community is regenerate only. And I would be like, I don't see how that follows. Like, that was the part. And that was the key thing that undergirded why you only baptize professing adults or professing people, because the new covenant community. And I'm going, and so when I look at the scriptures, I'm like, it seems pretty obvious that there's a mixed community, like that you have to issue warnings like, take care, brothers, lest there be in any of you an evil, unbelieving heart. And so it's like Paul or the author of Hebrews seems to think there could be evil, unbelieving hearts among the brothers. And so he at least, and I know that Baptists go, yeah, that's possible, but we try to avoid it. And so I get that. But like the discontinuity question on that point seems to me to be a continuity thing. Like the old covenant was filled with mixed and therefore had to be exhorted, taught, hey, don't quit, don't flake out, don't commit idolatry. So does the new covenant. So the communities on that point, that's not a place where it's different. And then on the places where it is different, it's like the Spirit's poured out and we don't have priestly mediation in a temple somewhere. We have a high priest in heaven. And all of that is the better, the new, the great. And it's like, I think that's actually a common ground between Baptist Presbyterians, which is really important. So those are kind of the two big ones, like the mixed community in the new covenant, and then kind of the household as a entity that a husband can speak for.
Great. And I think I think I'm not violating any of the things that I've recently done when I say as a Baptist, I think I can affirm those without violating the BFM or the 1689 or our statement of faith. Because this issue, when you plant a church or just you're a pastor, and you're meeting with somebody to become a member of your church, they've been baptized, whether as a pedo or a credo, there's a level of discretion and introspection that you're assuming into the nature of regeneration that you can perceive in the individual.
Right.
So sometimes as pastors, and this is why I'm going to talk about it right now, because it comes up throughout church history. This isn't a new conversation. Mm-hmm. This is like the Puritans were trying to figure this out. And New England, yep. They were like trying to figure out how rigid do we need to be? Of course, they were all Pado Baptists, but they were also Congregationalists. But how rigid do we need to be when evaluating a candidate for membership? And you get some guys that are like super, like just you know, high walls of entry. And you get others that are like, you know what, that's not necessary. There should be pious devotion. There should be piety in the life, righteousness and holiness mm-hmm. expressed, but we don't need to get so ticky-tack or, you know, evaluative. But you also see throughout church history, I mean, early catechesis in the church was, you know, you, before you got baptized, you had to go through a long kind of mm-hmm. process of formation. So anyways, these are fun topics to talk about, I think. And thanks for spilling the beans on this episode.
Yeah, glad to do it. I think, you know, I think that, you know, having switched now, I do think that one of the things, I think Doug puts this in his book on baptism, 2000 Generations, but he talks about it's more important to keep the covenant than to keep the sign of the covenant. So like the sense of proportion on the issue. So it's like, it is an important issue to figure out when the water goes. But I still think, and I've thought this for years, almost all Christians of whatever denominational stripe think that you should do something to acknowledge when a baby's born.
Yeah.
You know, and Baptists just have baby dedications.
Yeah.
And then, and I know some Baptists are like, that's why we shouldn't. But like plenty of Baptists are like, we're going to thank God for the baby and commit to raise them in a Christian home.
Yep.
And then people think when the kid comes of age and sort of owns it for himself, you ought to do something to mark that.
Yep.
And the debate is really about like where the water goes.
Yeah.
And therefore like how the water functions in it. But like both of those moments kind of get marked out.
Yeah.
And once you kind of realize that like at a phenomenological level, everybody recognizes that like this is a thing. And then it's a debate about where the water goes. The more important thing is, well, do you thank God and commit to raise them in a Christian home and believe God's promises for them? And do you actually expect that when they're adults, they will cling to the faith that you have handed to them? Yeah. Or is it the sort of thing that they can, you know, that they'll go off? Yeah. And so I think the idea, you know, the believe the promises for your kids at a practical level, this has been a little bit of a mindset shift for me in the Baptist thing is really kind of going like, well, what if God did actually make promises to me for my kids?
Mm.
Right. Because I don't think as a Baptist, I really thought that way.
Okay.
It was like, I know that they got a blessing because they're in my home, they're in a Christian home, and that's good for them. And they're going to be taught the gospel and they're going to be brought to church. And hopefully they go up in the faith. But the idea that like the Bible actually says like, no, God has promised to be God to you and your kids, trust those promises. That's like, oh, that's a different level. And so that's been kind of a different, that's been a shift. I can feel like more under the surface for a lot of the things that I was already doing as a Christian dad.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you're a listener and you hear this, you can continue to pray for me. Joe has not convinced me or sold me on it.
That's right.
These are compelling arguments and important topics, I think. Deserve,
I would just like to say, Chase, attention. That like there are a lot more things that I pray for you about than your baptismal theology. Like there's like a list that I could think of, and like baptism's not at the top.
That's great. Lots to pray for here. Well, let's get into leadership and emotional sabotage. So
yes,
this book came about. It's either out or about to be out, and I'd like to know more of the kind of the background. You share some of it in the acknowledgments in the intro. What's some of the background that gave rise to you feeling like, I'm going to write this book, it's important for these things? How did you come to write this book?
Yeah, so probably like a decade or more ago, 2010, 11, 12, somewhere in there, I somehow got a hold of Edwin Friedman's book, Failure of Nerve, Leadership in the Age of a Quick Fix. And I can't for the life of me remember how I got it. I know that Doug likes it too. And I can't remember if he gave it to me or if I gave it to him, because I know he wrote about it sometime back in that day. But I remember reading it. However I came across it, I know Amazon has kept track of when I bought it. So I know that. But I'm like, I don't know what led to it. I remember reading it and being like, oh, wow, this is really, really provocative, but also very insightful on sort of how social systems work, how institutions work, whether institution of the family or the church or the government. And that running through is this common thread of these kind of emotional dynamics. And then the role of the leader in relation to them. So I remember being really helped by it. And I started using it in like a leadership class at Bethlehem College. It would be one of the core texts, and we would work through it. And a lot of what we were doing was basically, you know, Friedman's Jewish. He was a rabbi. He, I think, had some really wonky kind of process theology sorts of stuff. Hardcore evolutionist, like a lot of his explanatory frameworks are just evolutionary biology, history stuff. And so we're trying to like sort of sift and sort of plunder the Egyptians as we're reading this book, because there is a lot of, when it actually applies, helpful things, and sort of, you know, Christianize it, pull this out, build the house of God. So that's what I started doing. And then it was like, as time went on, it was like more and more of these things became evident. So in that sort of really turbulent time, beginning sort of 2014, 2016, 2018, 2020, it's just like more and more, I'm like, this is just what we're dealing with. This is what's happening. And the other thing that was happening at the same time, and for me, is I was teaching Shakespeare pretty regularly. And Shakespeare, a lot of Shakespeare's plays, especially the tragedies, have this sort of social turmoil dimension to them, and have some really perceptive analyses of like how that works as well. And so both of those, so I'm kind of got Friedman and I got Shakespeare, and I'm just watching it unfold for me. But all the time, I'm always having to like translate it, because Friedman has the evolutionary gobbledygook and Shakespeare, you know, speaks Shakespearean English, and you can't just roll that one out easily. So, and so I'm always having to like break it down, re-say it, try to get it in accessible form. So like the scent of empathy stuff kind of came out of that.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Okay.
That was sort of like a Friedman-y thing that Doug and I, talked about. And so when I was asked to be a Man Rampant, it was like, oh, scent of empathy, we should talk about that. So Friedman is the one who kind of dialed into like, oh, this anxious emotional system can be easily manipulated through empathy. So that's kind of where it was. And so then I've been teaching on this, and I've like had put together, not one pages, but like 5-page handouts summarizing the key insights of Friedman that I've used to like do with elder boards or with school boards, things like that, and like walk them through like, hey, these are the dynamics. And so then when I came out here, it was so Jake McAtee, who works for Canon Press, was one of my students. He was like one of the first people to go through that. And it was really shaping for him too. And so he was like, we need to get that out. And so then we just were like, hey, let's go for it and figure out a way to translate this in an accessible way that brings the best of what Friedman saw, but roots it in like biblical soil, to bring some of the Shakespeare stuff over. So I, you know, for better or for worse, like the first chapter has a bunch of Shakespeare. Sorry, people, if you don't like that, just skip it. You can get to the good. You can just jump over that. It's fine. But there's a bunch of nerds out there who are going to be like, oh, this is amazing. And so I wrote that part for you. Root it in biblical soil and then fully Christianize it. Like, what effect does the gospel, how does Jesus help us here? Because it's not enough to sort of, there's something underneath our leadership that has to be there for it to be faithful, and then apply it home, church, world, using the scriptures to kind of draw attention to the dynamics and how faithful leaders can lead through them.
Okay, great. And I want to get into some of the experiences you've had with talking to other people. But I think as we go throughout, because what I want to do is just kind of walk through some questions that popped up as I read through it. The first one, you know, early on in the book, you talk about institutions being shock absorbers. I think I kind of intuitively knew what you're talking about in terms of like, we look around the world and we're looking for institutions or people that can kind of hold their own, stand on their own 2 feet in the face of pressure. But how would you kind of explain that, or what examples could you give as an institution, as a shock absorber?
Yeah. So I think when you think, so I think both individuals can be shock absorbers and institutions can be shock absorbers. Institutions won't be unless they have certain kind of leaders. There's a relation there, but it's basically like when everything comes apart, when you live in a time of unraveling, like we do, people do feel a kind of like, the Friedman's term for it was chronic anxiety, where it's just like, there's an angst always running in the background. There's a, it's agitation, it's turmoil, it's confusion, and it's just kind of always there. And you can have a home. Some people grow up in homes where that's just kind of like the always running in the background is that angst. They can be in a church where always running in the background is that angst. And then all it takes is a little match and the whole thing blows up. Right.
Sure.
And then usually it'll reset to normal, but normal just means, you know, fumes in the room running on the background.
Yeah.
A shock absorber is someone who, when the thing blows up, is able to like absorb it without contributing to it. So when the, in a home, so probably one of the ways, this is the way Jake pitched me, he said, we need a book that'll do this, that'll create people like this. It was basically when there's a crisis and everybody's kind of panicky, when you think about it, there's a certain person who, when they show up, everybody goes, oh, thank God.
Right.
They're here. Oh, okay, good. Okay. They're here. Okay. And it's not because that person always knows exactly what to do, doesn't always have, like, it's not they're omniscient and all powerful, but it's that they bring a certain kind of steadiness into an otherwise agitated situation that, like, everybody kind of feels like they can take a deep breath.
Right.
So that guy in that room is a shock absorber.
Okay.
Because all the agitation, it's basically like when it comes to him, it doesn't stick and he doesn't like channel it back in. And then you can think about other situations. The converse is the sort of leader who, when they come into the agitated situation, it's about to get dialed up and he's going to be the throwing the weight around in a way that makes it worse. And oh no, he's here, right? It's oh no, he's here. And or sure. Oh, and it could be, or oh no, she's here, right? Like, and everybody now has to like walk on eggshells. And so it's that phenomenon that was like, that's what we want to get to. And we want to be the kind of individuals who in our homes and churches and whatever are shock absorbers. But then if it's effective, then you have a community, an institution that is a shock absorber. And so you may know families that act this way, that like when that family shows up as a group, that it's like they bring something healthy. It just feels like, oh, the air's different. You want to be this kind of church in your community where it's like, oh, when the riots happen, which they do, when the riots happen, you want it to be like, oh, but they're still here, right?
Yeah.
And it's that kind of like, that's a shock absorbing. It's like they can take the hit and they don't sort of send it along. They don't amplify it. They don't escalate it in that sort of way.
Okay. So let me ask this question now that I've got that example in my mind. So I think there's many people, many Christians, they go into the workplace, they hear what you're saying. They want to be that kind of person where people can look to them as a presence that is confident, certain in God's providence and sovereignty. But many times if you're a Christian and you step into places, a lot of people go, oh no, they're here. And I've experienced that with certain networks where I know that when I walk in a room, people aren't going, thank God they're here. They're going, oh no, they're here. You know? So so how do I understand that dynamic at play?
Yeah. Good. So, yeah, that's right. Because oftentimes in it, so that's the flip side. So when the crisis happens, it's, you want that guy because, oh good, he's here. When it's just the steady state fumes happening and it's just running in the background, that guy is more likely to set the match.
Okay.
So the reason that there's the oh no is because everybody knows how this goes and he's not going to accommodate the system's anxiety. He's not going to conform to it because he's steady. And so he's going to do what, you know, he's going to at least attempt to be faithful and to do so in a steady way. But that might mean he's going to be willing to push the button.
Yeah.
But everybody else is like there's ways in which institutions can begin to operate according to, instead of like having a mission of like, this is what we exist to do. It's like what the institution actually exists to do is not push that button.
Yeah.
And everybody is just like, whatever we do, just don't push that button. Then all of a sudden, the guy walks in the room who's like, I thought we were on mission, push the button, and everybody, and it blows up. And so certain leaders go, the highest priority is just don't make it blow up. And it's like, that's not a steady leader knows you don't have control over that, right? You have control over your own actions, your own emotions, your own orientation in the setting. Like, that's what you're responsible for. And you can't control results. And manage them. Whereas a lot of leaders are sort of obsessed with trying to manage results. And so then that's the angsty control that's like, okay, we got to do this. We got to do that. Okay. Whisper in this ear, whisper in that ear, and try to just make sure it doesn't actually do this. And so when somebody comes in who doesn't play by that rule, there is an, oh no, because he's about to push the button.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I'm not just thinking about me. I'm thinking about people that I pastor that go into a workplace or go to college. And they are that kind of, oh no, the Christian's here, you know, because the Christian that's going to speak clearly and accurately represent God's world from God's word and apply it and ask those questions. That's not for most Christians. They don't want to be that person.
Right.
Most people want to be liked. And so I always want to encourage them to be bold and to be steady. And I think that's a really helpful explainer there. So thanks for going there. Kind of dovetails into the next question, because Friedman uses this phrase, non-anxious presence, which has always kind of bothered me. Like, there's this phrase, do you remember, I can't remember who coined it, but like make Jesus not ignorable or something like that. It's kind of a weird like descriptor, non-anxious, you know? So you helpfully point to the biblical concept of being sober-minded. Really appreciate that. But, you know, what you're describing is, I think, what you and Friedman would say is a sober-minded, non-anxious person. One thing I've noticed is that this concept, and like I said, it goes back to this other thing you're talking about. It almost gets weaponized. Like, you're making me anxious, therefore you're not you're an anxious person. Yeah. You need to be a non-anxious presence. And by that, they mean make people feel comfortable and at ease around you. So help me understand the dynamic. What's going on there?
Yeah, good. So that language of non-anxious presence can be, I think, weaponized that way. So my word, I don't know if I ever used that in the book, because what I did, it realizes what Friedman is talking about, the biblical term for that is sober-mindedness, which is a better term than non-anxious presence. It's sober-minded. It's that steadfastness, that steadiness under control, but ready to act, not just passive bump on a log, not steady because you're dead, but steady because you're ballast. So that's a better term precisely for this reason, because by framing it in terms of a non-anxious presence, then people do flip it and say, a person who makes me anxious must not have a non-anxious presence. When it's like, no, actually your anxiety is your thing.
Yeah.
Not like, so the moment that someone tries to say you make people anxious, right? You make people nervous. Well, it's like, well, you have to ask some questions. Because why? Is it because I'm blowing up? Is it because I'm shutting down? Is it because I'm cold shouldering, throwing a pity party? All of those things could be making people anxious. And then in that sense, I'm contributing to it. But if I'm just coming in as cool as a cucumber, and if I'm steady and other people are nervous because I'm not steerable, right? I don't have the normal levers that anxiety gives you. Then yeah, I'm making you anxious because the normal button, because on the one earlier talking about push the button. Now this is, you have no buttons to push.
Yeah.
Right. Like if I put like the buttons that I might normally push with somebody else in this organization, if I try that on you, you're just going to keep moving right on through it.
Right.
And that makes me nervous because I can't control it. And so when people use non-anxious presence, I know two things. They've read Friedman, and then I can usually tell within 5 minutes whether it's like the soft sentimental version of Friedman, or whether it's the one that's like willing to go in. And like Friedman has these stories in his book where it's like, I know how anxious everybody in that room was when he said that thing, where he, you know, it's like they're on a panel and he's like, they're talking about art. And he's like, you know, this is the problem with propaganda. It's the problem with Soviet propaganda. And, you know, a lot of feminist propaganda works that same way. And like, it's a Q&A. And like, all of a sudden some lady runs to the mic, gets in the mic and is like, I cannot believe that you would just say that. How offensive that is, blah, 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 and starts going off. And Friedman's like, I didn't hurt you. I did not harm you. Right. I challenged your ideas. You need to sit down. And everybody's like, oh no. It's like, he's doing non-anxious presence. And I guarantee you that there was a whole bunch of people in that room who were like, oh no, he went there.
Right.
He pushed the button.
Yeah.
And that's that's the kind of leaders. So this is where in the, you know, when you think about the Apostle Paul and what he commends as both for leaders in terms of sober-mindedness, and then what we see him practice in the book of Acts, where he's constantly in situations where everything just absolutely goes nuts and he's never thrown by it, right? He's not trying to control it. He's just taking the opportunities as they come. He knows I'm not dictating this. I might get beat up. I might die. I might get arrested. But he's like, every opportunity, he had a mission and he was focused. He had clarity. He woke up every morning knowing who he is and what he was supposed to do. And so he was like, I'm going to keep doing it. And the world can do this. And he's just going to move. That's a sober-minded leader. That's the kind of leader I'm trying to commend.
Yeah, for sure. So with that comes in the human dynamic, because I think, you know, the illustration that comes to my mind is like, if you were in danger overseas and you're an American citizen, one of the best things that could happen would be a SEAL team drops from the sky and, you know, they surround you and they're like, we've got you. And you're like, yes, like everything's awesome now. That's kind of what I'm imagining. And this plays out in homes, this plays like you write about in the book. But it also, this, the leader you're trying to commend, it deals with the emotional state of the leader and passions. There's been a lot of discourse in the last half century, 100 years, particularly on emotions And this gets into theological anthropology, the composition of humans, like how they're made up. And there's literature on emotional intelligence, EI, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so this is a big topic for normal people, but also for leaders. And so how are we to understand passions and how do they play into this kind of sober-minded presence?
Yeah, so so passions is the Bible. So Friedman talks chronic anxiety. I translate that as passions. And the idea is passions are those sort of instinctive, impulsive, intuitive, knee-jerk, snap reactions to reality. And so I think this Bible uses this word a lot, and that's what it's referring to. And there's sort of a notion, this isn't explicit in the book, but sort of running behind in terms of the anthropology that I'm operating with, is a kind of like higher and lower sense of like the self, where you have sort of like your intellect and your will. Your intellect thinks things, your will chooses things, but then operate at the lower level, that more animal-like, the thing that whatever your dog does whenever it runs away, or your rabbit
visceral.
When it sees a wolf.
Yeah.
Visceral, yeah. We have that too. And it's really important that we do, because it's what keeps us alive. It's why you swerve before your mind even realizes that something jumped out. So it's a good thing, but it needs to be guided, governed, and shepherded by your mind. And when passions are those snap reactions, those immediate knee jerks. So things like desire, you see something, you want it. Sadness, you know, would be a passion. Anxiety, worry, fear would be a passion. Anger is a passion. Pity is a passion. So these are all passions, and they're all in their proper place, really a blessing. They're good. They build connection. They're part of what makes us human. When they run the show, they're absolutely destructive, because they're short-term, instinctive, and they can escalate quickly. They can blow up or they can shut down. So we live in a culture in which passions, emotions, whatever you want to call them, are running things. They're in charge and must be validated, affirmed, encouraged with no breaks. And so in a highly anxious system, in a agitated system, passions are the thing that's just running through the place. And I think one of the things that actually in writing this book that was kind of a fresh insight is that it's not always that the same passion is running through. It's just the passion is the common thing. So one person is sad, and that makes another person angry.
Right.
So this person's sad, and what it triggers is anger. Not could be at that person who's sad, or it could be at whatever made them sad. So this person is hurt. That makes me angry at that person. Well, now what does that passion to passion? And then over here, the person that you're angry at is now afraid. There's passion. And then now their fear leads somebody else to feel sorry for them. And so there's pity. And so it's just like passion is just careening through, and we're connected, and it just courses and it amplifies. And every time it runs through, it's like a bolt of lightning. So that's kind of the way that the passions operate, and is why empathy, which Friedman highlights and which I've notoriously highlighted, is kind of an arch passion, because it's the channel that they all run on. And so highly empathetic communities tend to have this kind of like plasma that everything just like runs through.
Yeah.
And is why they can get hijacked, because it means then the most reactive, the most immature, the most led by passions person is going to be able to steer the ship, derail the agenda, have everybody accommodate them, because you don't want them to blow up. The threat of the escalation, or the threat of the shutdown, the pity party. We all recognize these sort of dynamics, like in our families usually, right? Like, you know that like, oh, if I say that, then they're going to put on the sad face, right? And everybody's going to like want to accommodate. Oh no.
Yeah.
And so that's the feature. And sober-minded leaders have to be the sort of people who shepherd their own, and therefore are immune to the kind of steerage that passions typically are for people. So we're not conformed to the passions, led by, deceived by the passions.
Yeah. And this plays out, I mean, even in the church, you'll see this in established churches, but also church plants, where like, I would say in the, you know, recent focus on community groups, missional communities, whatever you want to call them, a lot of the emphasis, whether in the Bible study itself or the missional engagement, which, you know, can happen as well, but it creates these kind of enmeshed communities where everybody's super empathetic. And there's a draw nowadays for a lot of young people, and even for older people too, to be in that kind of community. It's right. Like super tight. We're all like, we're all doing everything together all the time. We all feel the same way. And I've experienced when I've been in multiple groups, when that's the expectation. And then when I show up and I'm like, yeah, I'm not here to do that. We're here to do a Bible study or, you right. know, like I want to care for you if you need care, but that's super disappointing to a lot of, especially Christians right. that well-meaning yeah. Christians grow up in the church. Their expectation of the church is give me a friend group day one. And then that friend group needs to be my best friends like I had in college. Mm-hmm. And so they come in with these high expectations for an empathetic community. And that can be really, a lot of churches cave to that. You know, they just yeah. go, cool, well, how can we be like, they use the word relational, and there's nothing wrong with being relational. Being relational is good, but it's right. highly relational. I would say even highly empathetic. And after 12, 13 years of ministry, my wife and I can see it when we see other churches kind of running this play. Yeah. And it's like very like, as the youth might say, or maybe millennials just say, cringe. It's very just like, like that's a ticking time bomb. Because as soon as somebody comes in with mm-hmm. passions that are not maintained, that have not been cultivated, that have not been shaped to desire the Lord, all of a sudden it's going to blow up. Mm-hmm. Does that kind of track with what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that's right. So I think the psychological categories of enmeshment, fusion, things like that are identifying this problem, and it's the absence of boundaries. So Friedman's term for that was differentiation. And I try to wrap that into kind of that, you know, differentiation with a non-anxious presence is his sort of like thing. Yeah. And I just was like, I am not going to say that because I'm going to lose most people. Instead, sure. I'm going to say sober-minded, which means you don't get drunk on your passions and you don't get drunk on other people's passions, because sober-mindedness is literally the opposite of drunkenness. So whatever happened, you know, the impairment, the clouding of the judgment, the clouding of the physical abilities, the moral, mental, you know, physical impairment stuff, that's what drunkenness is. And we know what it looks like when it's alcohol. And it's like you suffer a similar kind of impairment when your passions are raging. The same kind of like shutdown or blow up phenomenon. And I stress that because I think people hear passions and immediately sort of think of the blow up kind, like the sort of person who loses their head.
Yeah.
But part of the point is the person who shuts down whenever things get uncomfortable and just can't even operate, and they just cold shoulder, they need to leave, they storm out of the room. That's just as reactive. It's just as passion driven. And so it's either one of those is like I'm being led by my passions. And so sober-mindedness is I'm not going to be drunk on them.
Yeah.
And I'm not gonna be drunk on mine, and I'm not gonna be drunk on yours. And the way that you can often tell is how other people's affect you. And whether, in other words, when you start to realize, like I think probably one of the more, I think I say this a couple of times in the book, but like a big part of what I'm trying to do is you need to pay attention to your passions, because they're always telling you something. And so when you feel that little hesitation, when you feel that reluctance to say that thing, when you start to kind of like, I visually always do it. It's like you just do this. It's real subtle. You just walk in, but then you're like, oh, nope, I'm going to dodge that one. Oh, nope, I'm going to dodge that one. As soon as you're doing that, it's because you intuitively, instinctively know if I don't, something's about to go, and you're trying to avoid it. And so you ought to go, why did I do that? I felt like I needed to say that, and I just bit my tongue because why? And it's because you knew if you did, this person was going to go blow up and everybody was going to blame you, and they were going to come and put pressure on you to make it right and apologize, when all you did was calmly, coolly, and clearly say something true.
Yep.
And that's when you're like, oh, there's a crackle in the room. There is fumes in this air. And at any moment it could go up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I sometimes get in those situations where I don't know if there's a crackle until I say something. I'm like, oh no, I've stepped on a landmine. I did not know it was there.
That's right.
That's funny. All right, let's get into hurting a little bit. I want to read a section because I just find this really helpful. So you describe hurting. Is this a Friedman term, or is this one that you're
hurting?
Riffing
is a Friedman term. So if it's probably a Friedman quote, if it's actually using hurting. I think I talk about social stampedes, which was just like he said hurt, and I was like stampede. So I just like,
okay, cool.
Riffed it.
So whether it's described this way, a process where togetherness triumphs over individuality and everyone adapts to the least mature members of the community. The cycle of reactivity leads institutions to live in a constant state of tension. The goal becomes peace at all cost, otherwise known as appeasement. Don't rock the boat is a slogan and is wielded against the community's leaders, who are expected to take responsibility not only for their own actions, but for the reactions of others. Disruptions by the immature will be accommodated Anyone who seeks to take a stand will be characterized as cruel, heartless, insensitive, unfeeling, uncooperative, selfish, and cold. I would even add pugnacious, or, you know, other, especially in a Christian community, yep. they're going to weaponize Bible verses to shut it down. And then it says, as a result, the most immature members of a community come to set the agenda for the whole. So I think, first, how does this play on a church? Because maybe, you know, if you're just a member of a church, maybe you haven't seen this. And then second, so what do we do about that? How do we solve that problem?
Yeah. So that's definitely, that was my sort of summary of Friedman. And I think it plays out in a church because we know that the Bible commands us to be compassionate, to be kind. Then that it takes that good impulse and is a kind of corruption of it. So the Bible tells us weep with those who weep, rejoice with those who rejoice. This is good emotion sharing. So I whatever you experience, I'm going to try to join you in that thing. And that's all fine and good, provided that I'm staying tethered to something more than your emotions.
Right.
I'm able to step in there because I'm tethered to Christ. It's the compassion of Christ that I have, not just, here, why don't you just steer my little emotional vehicle here? I'll go wherever you go. So that's the thing that gets corrupted. So when it gets untethered, when it gets ungoverned, then the passions are just going to ride, and people will learn very quickly that this is how you get things done around here. Hmm. And it doesn't even have to be, like, I think sometimes you say something like that and people hear, so you think people are sitting around plotting how to manipulate and hijack. And I'm like, no, they actually don't even have to do that. Maybe some people do. I don't doubt that there are people that actually do, but like for the vast majority, it's actually just a learned habit. Yeah. They figured out very quickly that if they do this thing, they get their way.
Yeah.
And so they just slide into the pattern. And they know that in soft-hearted Christian communities where compassion is lifted up and elevated, as it ought to be, that this will be the way to, if you're not getting your way, this is how to get it. Yeah. And so leaders have to, so I think that the fundamental thing in terms of resisting it is A, recognize when that's happening to you and to other leaders. So you can often recognize when other people are starting to get steered by other people's passions and because they're starting to put the pressure on you. So you're feeling the pressure from a fellow elder, and it's because he's being led by the nose.
Yep.
So it's like awareness. You got to be able to see it, and you won't see it if you're not sober-minded. And then the second thing is you have to have clarity on what is this institution for?
Mm.
Like, what are we about? What are we doing? And wherever the steering wheel is trying to take us, is that where we want to go? Is it because, are we going there? You know, I can't remember if I say this in the book. I don't think I do, but like, I really push back on don't get steered.
Yeah.
And steered means something like to be motivated to do something, not because you think it is good and wise and true, but for some other reason.
Hmm.
So you're taking a course of action, not because it's good, wise, and true, but because emotionally, it will be a quick fix for something, for some emotional problem. Now you're being steered. And once you start doing that, people learn, oh, that's, I just, you know, reach up there and steer you. You got a steering wheel. I can just steer you. And,
totally.
And leaders have to go, what I'm charged with leading this thing. I need to know what it's for. What's my household for? What's the church for? What's the school for? What is it for? What has God said it's for? I want to stay on mission there and not have that agenda be hijacked by the most immature, reactive people who know how to get their way by steering.
Yeah, and think of a baby. I mean, we've got a baby in the home. It's like, if you as a parent, like, you can see this in your own heart when your child is steering, or, you know, they know how to get their way. And that's by God's design. They cry because they're hungry. That's the only way they communicate. But if you as a parent don't know how to rule in the home as a father, and then be a good mother to children, the whole hierarchy can be corrupted and perverted if those children are steering the home. You know, one thing I appreciate you saying, it's not necessarily nefarious, or to use you know, these non-terms, non-nefarious actors. I joke about this with my wife, or she'll joke about it with me. If I'm upset about something, I know three people I can call where if I tell them what's upsetting me, they're going to double my passions. They're going to amplify everything I'm feeling. And for me, honestly, it's almost helpful, because once I see their kind of extreme reaction to my pain, I go, Okay, yeah, this is probably ridiculous, but like that's it's not nefarious. It's just right. like, dude, can you believe this guy? Oh my gosh, let's go. You know, like they're going to, and that's not necessarily wrong or sinful. I don't think it's just the way people connect, but like, it's just really intuitive for most of us that when we get around certain people, we know what to do, how to operate. It all starts in the home. It all starts in how we were raised with a father and mother and how that works. And I think it goes back to your original point of like, who's that person that shows up and you're like, thank God they're here. I think my dad that way. Like if he comes and I've got a problem and he shows up, I'm like, okay, we're gonna figure it out. Or like when COVID hit and I kind of freaked out and I did my passion reaction, which was, I don't know what to do. I'm going to go into my office and just sit for a little bit. And then once Matt was in the room, I was like, he's a guy that can figure this stuff out. Let's lean on him a lot. And so I just think this is a really helpful explainer for a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And it's not because that person, again, is omnicompetent or omniscient, but what they lack is they're not clouded. The reason you're grateful is they're not clouded the way that most people are clouded. Mm-hmm. And they're able to see things clearly. And even if they get it wrong, the other thing is they can course correct.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, oh, new information came. We did this. New information shows up. Oh, we can change. And it's not this angsty, like, oh, how do we change? It's not reputation management. It's not like, which I think is a big part of the steering wheel phenomenon among Christians is the fear of loss of reputation. What do we be known for? And so that person is not mainly thinking, how do we manage reputation? It's how do we do what's good and wise? And so if new information means we got it wrong the first time, that's okay. I'm not God. He's God. Yeah. And now he just let me know this. And so let's shift gears. And it's that steadiness that everybody goes, oh, we can do that. We don't have to panic. No, you don't have to panic. Just shift gears.
Yeah, it's a blessing to be that kind of person to other people. And it's a blessing to be around those kind of people. Yeah. Your publisher tweeted out this week, I thought it was just really funny because I've experienced this before, tweeted out, one day you share a Doug Wilson article on social media. A handful of members reach out to another pastor at your church expressing their concern. And now the senior pastor wants to meet with you to discuss the matter. What do you do? I think this was so funny to me because I've had it happen and I know many friends have had it happen to them. And of course, Wilson, I've joked about it with him on the pod, is like, you know, he's the perfect example of this, and especially in certain church communities. And so the, you know, Canon Plus account or Canon Press account asks, what do you do? So I'm asking you, Joe, what do you do? What do you, it's like what I did is I recorded the conversation and then put it on a pod. Like, what are you supposed to do in that situation?
Right. Here's what you don't do. You don't panic and you don't get steered. So like you start with, like the reason to, you know, part of our goal, I think we have more of these coming. So hopefully there's some good ones. That one's a good one. Is it meant to, you go, oh, I feel the angst there. And it's like, okay, so the answer, the first thing you need is you need to be the sort of leader who doesn't get steered by the angst and whose highest priority is not relieve the angst at all cost. Instead, it's lead. And so if you get called to the principal's office for something like this, you want to be the sort of person who's not offended or panicked by it. You don't need to, or even offended. Like, it doesn't need to be the sort of thing that, like, how dare you, you know, because that's just a reactive response too. Like they're angsty because they're worried about reputation. And now you're offended because they called you in. Instead, it's like, oh, great. Is this an opportunity? And I think this is like the Pauline point where it's like, oh, they just arrested me. Opportunity. This is God bringing opportunity. So what's the opportunity for? And it's the opportunity to be curious, to say, okay, let's talk about it. Yeah. You want to discuss the matter? What's the problem? Was there anything in the article that was false?
Well, right.
No, that article was fine. So then why was it a big deal?
Right.
And so you're curious. What you're trying to do is your steadiness and steadfastness and sober-mindedness in that moment is hopefully going to help them dial down their agitation and be able to think rationally for a minute. Okay. Yep. Or it's going to actually, this is again, you can't control, or it's going to cause them to absolutely lose their ever-loving minds.
Yeah, for
because you're not joining them. You're not playing to type. You're not being defensive to where they could say, oh, you know, we just wanted to talk about it. And he got so angry and yelled at us for policing his tweets. Instead, you're just like, oh, yeah, great. Love to talk about it. And and then you press in to try to get behind, where is it coming from? What's feeding it? Why are we letting thing. And then, and that's when everybody always should have, you know, in your, in that situation, it's, well, so-and-so shared that. Why wasn't that a problem?
Mm-hmm.
And then you just sit in silence for a minute while they have to like realize, oh, wait, there are certain things we police in one way. Yeah, we do. Yep. Why do we do that?
Yeah.
And you're starting to try to get into like, what's underneath this? What's fueling the angst?
Yep.
And the question is not, like there may be circumstances where somebody shares something and they shouldn't have. That's not sure. The issue. It's why do we make the decisions that we make? What's actually leading us and guiding us in doing this? And is it ad hoc herding? Is it social stampedes? Everybody runs left. Well, I guess we got to run left. Everybody runs right. I guess we got to run right. And you're just following. You're a herd, not a pack. And instead you're a leader and you should be going, no, we're not sheep. Now at some level, I get it. Everybody's sure. Sheep to Jesus,
yeah.
But
yeah.
Like you're called to be the shepherd. And so, yeah, the sheep see the wolf, the sheep see the problem, the sheep freak out, or the sheep see nothing and they just freak out and are stupid because they're sheep. And it's like, your job is to not just be another sheep. Don't just be another emotional domino. And so That angsty thing is an opportunity for you to bring some clarity. So I've been in meetings where people are like, why are you doing this? And it's really animated. And I've said, because this is the most important thing I can do for this institution right now is to not budge on this issue. If you have reasons, I'm willing to hear them. Open Bible, open mind. I want to be the most reasonable, persuadable person in the world. But if it's simply emotional angst and passions that are trying to steer, I'm going to dig in and say no.
Yeah.
And that's leadership. That's actually leading right there.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, just to encourage whoever's listening, this is a learned trait. You don't all of a sudden, you know, wake up tomorrow and be this type of man or type of leader. You actually have to try it and fail. You have to try. And that doesn't mean you need to, like, don't go. If you know that if you push that button or, you know, you strike that match, not out of a sense of revenge or something like that, but like, no, like this is really helpful. I think it's really true. Choose an easy one to start with, you know, and like you can try the. And I would say even before that, it has to start in the home where you know how to do this with your own wife. You have to be able to, you know, stay steady. And, you know, Lord knows none of us do this perfectly. And we all have to learn over time. And yet this is a skill that is so necessary today because so many people lack it. And so, yeah, I just think this is a crucial, important thing. One of the things that you talk about in the book is slander. And I reference this and I can put a link in the show notes to my sermon. I don't normally do that, but I use some of Joe's material in my sermon because this is a form of persecution and it gets into reputation management and how the world will seek to slander you. And this has happened to my church in the last year. And so, you know, when Christians experience slander, Joe, what are kind of some principles we should abide by when you know, the local press, let's just say they called you the Christian Taliban. I don't know. You know, like let's say they do that. No, never. What are some principles we should operate by when assessing those accusations from the world?
Yeah, good. So the first is obviously recognizing that slander is a steering wheel of choice for God's enemies. The devil's a slanderer. That's what a diabolos is. He's an accuser and he's a slanderer. So he's a liar from the beginning. And so this is a choice weapon of God's enemies. And it's designed as a steering wheel. And I think recognizing that there's often two dimensions to it. One is to get you to steer you first, but failing that, it will be to steer you by your soft-hearted friends. So it's that your friends are actually a target here. It's if they can't get to you, they'll try to make you so toxic that nobody will stand next to you. So know how it works and it's appealing to this desire for a good reputation, which the Bible says is more valuable than riches. So how could you be against that? Well, it depends. Like it's a relative good, not an absolute one. And your reputation is not more important than faithfulness. If you could have a great reputation while being unfaithful, that would be bad. That's not what you're after. So the two kind of basic rules that I kind of commend is A, be willing to be slandered. Jesus promises that this will happen. This is not, you know, when Peter says, don't be surprised, just stop being surprised. And it is an amazing thing how many Christian leaders especially are surprised by this. The expectation that has been cultivated is that if you seek the good of the cities right? If you seek to bless and love your neighbor, that it will be and do all of these good things while being winsome and patient and everything else, that everybody will love you. And it's like Jesus did that and they hated him. He got strung up on a cross for that. And they did so while lying about it, right? Drunkard, glutton, blasphemer. And so those lies, people really believed them in the first century. They believed that Paul was in it for the money. They believed he was just trying to puff himself up. They had convinced themselves that was true, and it wasn't, and they were weaponizing it. So the first thing is, if they called the master of the house Beelzebul, how much more the members of his household? You're in good company. Don't be to be willing. The second thing, though, I think is as important, which is make sure the slander is false. Like, don't live in to the evil thing that they think you are. You know, there's the old quote that's like, well, if I'm going to be hanged as a thief, I might as well steal something. And I think that in sort of like the modern internet age and kind of like the black pill phenomenon, I think kind of leans into that. It's like, well, if they're going to call us names, we might as well be that thing. And it's like, well, don't do that. Instead you're calibrating yourself by like, well, what does God think about that thing? So if they're calling you a name and it's something that God approves of, welcome it. No reason to change. If they're calling you a name and God also hates that thing, repent of it.
Yeah.
Right. Don't become the evil thing that they think you are. Instead, just cheerfully care about what God thinks and don't let the slander be the steering wheel.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think, you know, it's difficult because there's a sense of fun that you can have with it. And I see this in the business world where you'll get a business that gets a bad review on Yelp and they'll make it like a doormat in front of their business. I don't know if you've seen that. I think that's a lighthearted way to do it. And I think, you know, it can be funny. And I think Wilson has done this before. So there's a way to do it to where, you know, you disarm them by making a joke of their weapon. But there's also like you highlight, the danger of like, well, yeah, if they're going to call me a bigot, you know, I'm going to be one. Or you look at somebody's Twitter bio, and I've thought about doing this, but I think it would just be unhelpful. It's like, put all the bad words people have said about me in my Twitter bio. You see this with a lot of people, right? And I don't necessarily think that's wrong. But one question that comes up with this is, okay, we want to investigate and make sure the slander is false. But I see lots of organizations, schools, homes, churches get taken offline because they're constantly self-policing because of these accusations. So how do we avoid that?
Yeah, good. So I think there's no hard and fast. These are all wisdom calls. So the first thing is, if what you're doing is always, when the slander comes, you're defensive, then you're a reactive response and you're being steered. They've successfully derailed you. Whatever you want to talk about, we're not talking about, because you're defending yourself from the slander. And once people learn that they can open that door by knocking, you're going to get a lot of knocks if you try to be faithful. And the more that you try to be faithful, the more knocks you'll get, because they know this is the way to get it off mission. So you don't want to fall in that trap. So the kind of rough and ready thing is, to the degree that the slander seems to be damaging God's reputation in places that you actually care about. So not God's reputation among the folks that hate God, right? It's not his reputation is not great there. Yours shouldn't be either. But in places where you're like, you know what, we have people who are constantly having to answer this question. We have people who, don't know how to answer it because we've let it just kind of, we just ignored it. If there's ways that you can figure out how to clear the air, at least put out the other side, or, discredit the accuser in certain ways, I think all of those are legitimate tactics in the face of slander. So it's not wrong to say, hey, this is what we did. And then the thing is, I think it's always like, get back to your message. So this is what I see Paul doing again and again in the book of Acts, is he gets arrested, he gets an opportunity, the thing blows up, and he's like, this is an opportunity for me to tell them about Jesus. I'm gonna talk about how Jesus changed my life. It's not mainly about Paul's reputation at that point. It's, I have a captive audience for a minute. What do I want to say to them? And this is, I think, one of the ways that I think Moscow has actually done this well, is that bad publicity is a kind of like, well, what do we want to say?
Yeah,
they just like, our enemies just handed us a mic through their slander. Great. Let's speak clearly into it. And it can't be about, well, but we let it go unanswered, or there's evil people are still going to think bad about us. It's like, well, okay, you can't. That's the thing you have literally zero control over. Right. So instead, seek to be faithful in the face of it, and don't just jump because somebody screamed the one name that you'd never want to be called.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and that's why I think our elders were pretty prudent in that. We wrote an op-ed in response to the op-ed that came up, and we preached the gospel. And even people who disagree with me on whether it's political matters or anything else, they're like, hey, that was really good. And I was like, we tried to do our best, you know. we just highlighted Jesus and talked about how all people need to worship Jesus. That was a unique opportunity.
The other thing to think about here, I think, is because Christians are very sensitive to the what we're known for thing, I think recognizing, like, you're free to make some mistakes on this. Like, it's not an easy thing. It's kind of what you were saying a second ago. Start with something simple. It's like, you're not going to be great at this the first time it happens or the fifth time it happens. You're going to whiff sometimes in how you respond. But try to make the whiffs ones that you meant to do. In other words, it's like, don't insult people unintentionally. But if you're going to respond and be funny, know what you're doing and the likely result. Don't be just flippant about it, and don't be reactive about it. Because oftentimes there's different ways of being steered, and don't take the bait either way. You want your enemies to be responding to you, reacting to your actions.
Yeah.
Not you constantly being reacting to whatever they're doing and you're trying to manage it.
Yeah.
A lot of times, this is one of this is a Friedman insight, but good leaders know that crises cannot be managed. They have to be endured. They can't be fixed. You can't fix it. You have to endure it. You just no way out but through. So just press on, keep doing what you're doing, and let, like, entrust yourself to the one who judges justly.
Yeah, that's great. And I think this is just, it's fundamental for churches today that we've been in an ecclesial environment where there's, like, in the city for the city, the other kind of church planning slogan that was always kind of it's become an albatross for a lot of churches, but they always kind of go like, if your church left the city tomorrow, would anyone care? You know?
Yeah.
And like, it's supposed to put pressure on you to perform so that the city feels a certain way about you. The loss feels a certain way. And it's just like, I think it's keeping a lot of churches back from owning the word of God publicly and just saying plainly what needs to be said. That's why I think this is just so crucial today. Just real quick, how much more time do you have?
A few more minutes, whatever you want.
Okay, cool. My dog is like barking at the back door. Yeah, let's go a few more minutes because I want to talk about winsomeness. Okay, so I just talked about why it's so crucial. Okay. You know, one topic that I've talked about on my podcast is winsomeness. And I want to kind of tie this in with cowardice. And I know that's kind of loaded because I don't know that all the winsome mean to be cowardly. Okay. I think there's a lot of churches out there that are just kind of doing the whole winsome thing, using that word, and they're not doing it. They're just maybe naive or whatever. But how does winsomeness play into kind of this culture in the church today where they're very, soft on some issues and hard on other issues? How have you seen that play out?
Yeah. So winsomeness is like all of these things, you know, I hope that one thing everybody gets is these are all corruptions of good things. So you can always find, like, figure out what the good version of that thing is and go like, okay, that's what it's for. So the concern for winsomeness is Paul says, I can become like all men in order to save some. I'll become like these to be win these. I'll become like those, win those. So he's adapting himself in order to remove as many offenses, unnecessary offenses from his message in order that they can hear the actual thing. That's the good form. He does it. We see him do it in Acts. The bad form is when it becomes like, well, let's pare down the rough edges of the truth because that'll be offensive. Let's just wait till they're after they're in and we'll talk about all the gnarly stuff, all the stuff that's going to really, that they might not like. Let's see if we can get have them sign the card first, have them get all the way in and then spring it on them. Like, oh yeah, by the way, it also means this. And and that sort of thing is both cowardly and deceptive. You know, I remember when, I think it's who's the reporter that kind of really that came to Christ through, I think, Keller's ministry.
Yeah, I can't remember the name.
Kirsten something.
Yeah.
Anyway, I remember reading something by her where she felt like it was a bait and switch, where it was like she had no idea that this church that she was kind of becoming attached to and was all about Jesus and everything else, that they also believed that like abortion was evil. And so it was like we just don't talk about that sufficiently. Let's keep that under wraps. And then she felt like it was a bait and switch, or that women couldn't be pastors because Keller did hold the line on that. So that sort of like muting things or paring down. And it's usually driven by a pious desire to see more people come to Christ. The problem is that it puts the first question becomes, what are we known for? And then now you've just given them a steering wheel, because all they have to say is, well, what you're really known for is this thing. And then the other thing is that winsomeness, that one of the easiest ways to like be winsome to one group is to be hostile to a different group. So you ingratiate yourself with one group, you share their sensitivities, you share their sensibilities. What do they care about? We're going to care about that. But it also means, and the things that the people that they think are the problem, we also are going to agree with them. Yeah, they're the problem. And so in the modern form of winsomeness, like where that word took root, it was sort of it privileged one group of unbelievers and then rejected a group of Christians in order to ingratiate with that group of believers. We're not like those Christians, which literally is something that Jesus put in a parable that you should never, ever do, right? Thank you, God. We are not like those Christians, the embarrassing ones. And so it was like, we're going to stiff arm our fellow brothers in order to ingratiate ourselves with unbelievers. And we'll feel pious because it's all for the sake of mission. It's all for the sake of evangelism. And that's how it can really, really go wrong. As opposed to saying, you know what, no matter what, these are my people. You're not my people. These are my people. Christians are my people. And I know that that was stupid what they did. I also think it was stupid, but my allegiance is to them. And if you try to sort of, if there's any hint of like driving a wedge there, then the first thing I'm going to do is call up that crazy pastor down the road and be like, hey, we need to be in public together. Like, we need to be seen as Christians or more fundamental. So I think that's where one of the ways that like winsomeness became it elevated a good thing to an ultimate thing. There, I just use Keller again, right? Like,
sure.
It took a good thing, your reputation, what we're known for, and it made it more ultimate. And then therefore meant on certain issues, let's just tread lightly so that nobody knows.
Yeah.
And maybe we can talk about it quietly in a back room somewhere someday.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah, I've seen that play out. And then lastly, as we tied into kind of cowardice, you know, there's an interesting verse in Revelation about cowards, and some people translate it differently, but you know, cowardice is not something God wants for his people. We're to be strong and courageous and many other things, more than conquerors is what Paul calls us in Christ Jesus. But why do you believe cowardice is contagious?
Yeah, so, well, it's part of, because in the book of Deuteronomy, when they're in the middle of that war, or when God's giving them laws for warfare, and he's like, if you're in war, the commander should go to the troops and say, is anybody afraid? Go home.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, lest, you know, you make the hearts of your fellows melt. So like the danger is not like one guy running away is not great. But if other guys see that one guy running away and they start running, what do you have? Well, this is a social stampede. This is just a herd.
Yeah.
And so he's like, if that's you, you have no business being in this fight.
Yeah.
Because you will cause the hearts of your brethren to melt. And so cowardice is contagious in that sense. It's because it's a passion. It's the same fear making you run away, and then it just courses through the rest of the troops. So the same thing would be true. But the good news is it's also true, the flip side. Courage is contagious, right? Courage is actually a really contagious thing. There's a lot of, we're seeing this a lot right now, and it actually is a way to bring back, you know, if you wanted to recover winsomeness, it's like, if winsomeness was targeting one thing and saying like, hey, we want to make Christianity attractive to this group of people, you know what's attractive right now to a whole lot of people? Like courage is. Like just bold, straight, direct speech is really and especially even to like what we might call the normie non-Christian, you know, the grillers who are like, and they're looking at the world and going, this is nuts. And whenever, if you're the Christian who's like, yes, it's nuts and here's the way out, that actually might have some, like, that's the felt need. I was talking about some friends, like, you know, Seeker Sensitive was always about felt needs, and the urban push was all about, was basically a seeker sensitive thing directed towards cities and progressives, which in and of itself could be good if you're actually drawing them to the full thing and not just the partial mishmash. But now what's the felt need? Well, it's like, would somebody just say the thing?
Right.
And that's winsome. Let's be winsome by being courageous. Because its courage is actually encouraging.
That's great. It's in the word. It's beautiful.
It's in the word. It's literally what the word encouragement just means. Like, I am encouraged by your courage.
That's great. Yeah. And it doesn't take much, just listener. I mean, like, Yeah. I just wish you understood and you could hear the heart I have, and I think Joe has, with just for everyday people, just to remain faithful to the Lord, speak plainly about what he says. Don't be embarrassed by the word of God, and don't give into the social pressure to distance yourself. And that was a mistake I've even made as a young church planter. You know, we're not like those Christians. We're different, you know, and it's like, reject all that, man. Like, there's a huge opportunity right now. And that's why I'm excited about what God is doing, and why you've written this book is there's just a huge opportunity to reach people, to glorify God with our faithfulness in this day. And I think that us being courageous, whether it's like just saying things, maybe to blunt force trauma, or saying things in maybe a nuanced way, each person has a different temperament, but I think we all can link arms behind standing firm, standing fast on God's word in these days. And that is inspirational to other people. And so, Joe, I'm really thankful that you wrote this work. Going to be buying copies to give away for sure. Where can people pick up a copy?
EmotionalSabotage.com is the URL they've got. So you can pick it up there. And I hope it's helpful. It's I tried to keep it short, sweet, to the point, and get at the heart of it. And then I think the applications hopefully will be endless.
Excellent. All right, Joe. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.